Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and that, by the way, was the beautiful voice of Francil Garwin. You can hear more of Francil's music at francil.com. I love Francil because each song is like a prayer, and it always moves me very deeply to listen to her music. So that's why we play it a lot to start our show. With me today is my dear friend, both of my dear friends and co-hosts, Andre Rodatis and Crystalline B. Larson. Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Good morning.
Hi. Good to have
Hi.
You. Always hear your voices. And we have a special show today, and we want you guys to call in. Please call in and share your experiences with us if you can. We'd love to hear from you about your experience with sharing the Urantia book with young people, especially your children, trying to develop a family culture around the superlative teachings of the Urantia book, especially the teachings about God and a friendly universe, and, you know, in the face of all the alternatives out there that say something different. And, you know, what has been your experience? We'd love to talk to you about it. We're going to do a study for the next couple of weeks on this topic. So our call-in number is 646-716-8158. And I will post that on the board as well. So this was born by Crystalline and I having a chat about second-generation Urantia book readers. Crystalline is a second-generation reader. She's been, she was dyed in the wool, so to speak. I think your folks found the book in 1955, right, Crystalline? Right when it was first published, almost?
No, it was actually the early 60s.
Okay, well, I'm thinking of Dr. Sprunger then, but I know he was
right.
Instrumental in sharing it with your parents.
Mm-hmm.
So you've essentially grown up with the concepts, and you love to talk about how your dad made them come alive for you and your brother when you were just really small. And, you know, we run into this, all the various problems with sharing the teachings of the Urantia book with, cohorts and people we work with. That's one thing. But family and friends is quite another thing. And, of course, family is one of the toughest things of all, especially if there's already a pre-existing religious culture that's fairly dogmatic. And with concepts about, we know the Urantia book gives us concepts about God that are just unsurpassed. I can't imagine there's a more beautiful concept of God anywhere on the planet. And we want to share that with our children. I know my daughter was a year old, my oldest, when I found the Urantia book. And she grew up with the concepts of the book, and my son did, and so did my youngest now. And I wouldn't dream of keeping those beautiful concepts away from my children. But I didn't have a spouse who was opposed to them either. So it's really challenging. And I know, Crystal, and you came up in a family where both your mom and dad were in love with the Urantia book and its teaching. So it wasn't really a conflict between the two of them. Is that right?
Yes, it is. And I think that does make a significant difference in being able to create that type of family culture for kids to learn about the fifth epical revelation. But I also don't think it's the only way. You know, I hope that we can discuss during this series the challenge for spouses who don't have a mate who's open to the Urantia teachings and how they can still manage to share these ideas with their children.
Yeah, we've had some callers who have expressed to us that they want to share the concepts with their children. And, you know, even if your spouse isn't opposed to it, it can still be daunting to try and share some of these concepts. And there have been readers like Mary Livingston, who has written a book for young children, The Young Child's Guide to the Urantia Book. She wrote that under the name of Mary Eben. And she's also written a book for her spouse that became a beloved book. I mean, it's been translated now into several languages, and it's simply called The Urantia Book Basics, and she recently rewrote it and changed the name to Teetering on the Brink. But, you know, she literally wrote a book to help her children and her spouse understand the Urantia book. She wrote two books. And so it's not an easy thing to share these concepts with your children either. And what we're hoping to do is to hear from our callers, and the three of us will share some ideas, some things that have worked for us and some things that haven't. And Andre, I know that you married your first spouse was somebody who was pretty steeped in a traditional religion. Is that right?
Yeah. She had grown up Catholic, just like I had. She wasn't so fully steeped in Catholicism or presently practicing that we couldn't talk about things. And in fact, when we first got married, what appeared initially as pretty hopeful for me in marrying her was that she did appear to be pretty open to new ideas and ideas about God that were more around the personal nature of religion. It helps to have grown up in a similar religion to know some of the ins and outs and pitfalls. And one of the things that was a big part of her growing up in Roman Catholicism was the fact of the nuns.
We could do a whole show just on the nuns.
The nuns.
The nuns.
I could just hear sort of like a big boulder dropping in a huge pond and seeing a huge ripple go anyone who has any idea of what it's like to grow up Catholic, that's all I had to say was the nuns. actually that's not entirely true, because some people have only good experiences with those wonderful sisters who choose to become literally, quote unquote, the brides of Christ and remain celibate their entire life and decide to devote their life to God, and and very often become school teachers and act throughout the Catholic Church that way. But her experience in Peru, which was where she grew up, was very, very challenging, and she did experience some of the other aspect of what could be part of that experience with the nuns, and especially as a Catholic schoolgirl and as a Catholic schoolboy, I did know, you know, just how disciplined and disciplining the nuns could be. So that sort of put her with not a full positive memory of Catholicism and a willingness to explore other things. What unfortunately developed in our relationship was that at some point the Arantxa book became a foil when our relationship went south. It became that when she needed to become adversarial with me, part of it was becoming adversarial about the Arantxa book.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it was used that way because in later years, and maybe I shouldn't get to this right away, but in later years, when we separated, there was actually encouragement to start a Arantxa group with the kids in order to make sure, quote, that they had some kind of, that they were getting enough spiritual training, unquote, while they were growing up in their teens and late childhood, you know, when we did separate. And that, to her credit, was quite an interesting conclusion to jump to, that that would be a good thing. And as a result of that, the kids and I got to get through the first 10 papers as a family study group together. Now, we talked about all kinds of things while they were growing up, but, you know, I won't get to all of that right now. But that did allow us to actually have a family study group for a period of time, even though at some point the interest started to wane as they entered more into their teen years.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I think that's
normal for even people who have a pretty strong family culture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it is.
I'm very thankful to have had that experience, and you know, there was enough good feeling that once things did subside with regard to adversarialness, or when that wasn't present, very often the kids, and you'll remember this, were accompanying me to study group, to many Arantxa activities, and I look at it as one of the signal. I don't want to call it a point of pride, but there is a little bit of pride there. Hopefully not before a fall. But in our Arantxa community in Colorado, we had one of the first group mass celebrations of the advent of the thought adjusters of our children, where we had them walk under an arch and had a literal ceremony in community acknowledging them. And I remember my kids and the Thurston's kids and a number of people in our community that went through, walked under this arch, the Halversons, I believe, and others, that they were acknowledged for having received their thought adjusters. It was literally acknowledging that they had their thought adjuster day. And that was probably the first time that it happened on this planet. Somebody can call in and correct us, but this was a number of decades ago, or at least a decade ago, or more, that we did this.
Yeah, probably more like two decades ago or more.
Yeah, probably. And
20.
Right. But they were acknowledged for this, and that was probably the first time that it happened on this planet since the days of Adam and Eve.
Well, I think it's such an important occasion, and we already have a couple of callers, so we're callers hanging there. We're going to get with you. Crystalline, I want to point out, that has prepared some quotes for us to take us through, and no small surprise that the Urantia book has an awful lot to say about this. And it's woven throughout the whole book, the responsibility, the parental responsibility of mothers and fathers to reveal the nature of God and a friendly universe to their children. And many readers have come away with this idea that they shouldn't, there's a quote in the book that says, don't force a ready-made experience upon your children. And many readers have come away with this idea, oh, well, gee, I can't share the Urantia because my kid has to find God for himself. And we hope after the course of this study, people will realize that that's not necessarily the case. Children can't always find God for themselves. It's not that we have to be dogmatic or rigid in interpretations. It's that we have to reveal the real and loving nature of God and a friendly universe, the mother, to our children.
And I think the other thing to remember is that it is the family responsibility mm-hmm. to train children in their religious or spiritual culture.
Right.
And that is not the same thing as imposing a ready-made religion or ready-made ideas or ways of thinking to
yeah.
your children. I find that growing up with the Urantia book or having some of the concepts from the Urantia book as a child doesn't tell you what to think, but it helps to teach you how to think.
Exactly.
It helps to give you a clear, truth-based foundation on how to think. And remember, the Urantia book is one of the few places that you will ever read that truth is alive, that it's mm-hmm. living. And it must be experienced in order to be understood. And so providing higher concepts of God for your children to launch themselves with is hardly the same thing as giving them a ready-made religion. And for those people within the movement who've been trying to make a religion around the Urantia book, have been trying to create a religious structure, they would find how difficult it's been to do that because
right.
nobody agrees on what that should be. So it's hardly a ready-made religion.
Right.
Right.
And I think what Andre was pointing out with the nuns, you know, the Urantia book calls those religions of authority. And unfortunately, so many religions on the planet end up going in that direction and where, you know, there's some authoritative interpreter, the scholars or the theologians or whatever you want to call them, and they kind of hand down the authority and the ministry takes it up, and now they're in authority and they tell you what to think about God. And if you don't think this about God, then you are clearly wrong. And it stifles the creative imagination. It stifles the spirit of adventure in finding God. And as Jesus said, seek, ask, knock. And he promised that if you would do these things, if you would seek, you will find. If you will ask, you will be answered. If you will knock, the door will be open. That's the spirit of adventure I'm talking about. And that we should help our children. And I think, Crystalline, you've pointed out many times, your dad really ignited that in you. And Andre, you found it, I found it, because it was in us. I don't know how it got ignited, but, you know, I didn't really have a ready-made experience necessarily. I wasn't coming away from something real heavy-handed. I was clearly seeking, though. And I think that's the attitude that we want to have, is that attitude that, you know, perhaps God is bigger than we know. And greater than we know, and more than we know.
Yeah, and it's aside from the topic of this program, but I'm sure if you, anybody that is first generation, in other words, you did find it, you know, yourself. You were the first one in your family to find it. You can probably recall experiences where you were sort of parented through or guided through by a loving hand. I know that for me, you know, from the time I was six, if I reflect on it, or earlier, if I want to consider the fact that I did have a mother that did lead me with some very positive precepts in Catholicism, and not most of the negative ones. She did unfortunately let me know, God is always watching you. But she gave me a lot of good positives. She did let me know that God was a loving God. And mm-hmm. you know, when I think about the numbers of hurdles that I had to cross in order to find the Urantia book, I think of, you know, did somebody set these up, some of these things? Because, holy cow, how did I find all of these interesting experiences at such tender ages as I did? That's not usual for a kid to find that. And, you know, I had a reincarnationist poet speak to my eighth grade class and mm-hmm. went up to him and asked him afterward, and, you know, how did you come to these ideas and all this? But that is a digression from our topic of the show, and so I won't get off on that.
Well, let's take these callers.
Yeah.
Go ahead and finish your thought, and then we'll take these
callers. Well, all I want to say is that, you know, that we all have been parented along in one way or another by our angels, mm-hmm. by life circumstances, by having wonderful mentors, whoever it is that helps prepare our minds to be receptive to something like the Urantia teachings, because in practically all cases that I've seen, there's nobody that has ever taken a book and clubbed you over the head with it and said, you got to believe this.
Yeah.
Although I have heard there's always the exception that proves the rule.
Well, and you bring up a very good point, and we will get into this in the course of our discussions here, and that is how to recognize the spirituality in children and how to honor their search for God and realize that it's real and it's valid, and give them some guidance in that search. So I'm going to put
right.
these callers on. There's two callers that are both on area code 250. Caller, can you turn your computer down so we don't get the echo?
Please turn your radio down.
Are you with us, caller? Area code 250.
Hello.
Hi.
I don't think 250 may just be listening and not interested in...
I'm on 250.
Oh.
Okay, we're getting...
You're on Blog Talk Radio. Radio.
Can you turn off your sound on your computer?
I did. But I can still hear a bunch of reverberation.
Okay, I'm going to try something.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Holy,
it's just that the echo.
There must be some sound.
Try calling back in.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thank you for using Blog Talk Radio. Goodbye.
Well,
that
must have been
tricky.
An internal problem, because obviously even when we disconnected her, we still got the Blog Talk feedback.
Yeah.
Well,
sorry
actually,
about that.
You know, that was psychedelic. I hope you enjoyed it. I haven't heard anything like that for years.
God, reminds me of the 70s a bit.
It sounded a lot like Pink Floyd. That was fun. So, well, area code 250, I'll call back here. We'll get her back on. Here she is.
Hi,
are you with us?
250 again?
Hi.
Much better.
Hi. Yeah, I called in again. This is Debbie Bartman.
Oh, hi,
hi,
Debbie.
Oh, hi,
Debbie. How are
Deb.
You?
Good.
Hi, how is everybody?
terrific.
Doing really well.
Good. Yeah, about the topic of children, I guess, well, I have four children, and I had the Urantia book before I had the children, so they grew up with it. And I also had a husband who's not into, or have a husband who's not into the Urantia book, but he basically just gave me free rein to, you know, look after the whole spiritual thing with the children. So, which I did. But I think a lot of things were helpful. One of the things that I found with the kids that was helpful when they were young was the Tales of Joshua book, which was bedtime reading, which I thought, you know, is a great book for young children. And what I think was the most important for the kids was going to conferences and retreats with me and meeting other Urantia kids and the adults, because I think kids really respond to things emotionally, and it was always a really good experience for them. And that I think is most important for them to develop any kind of religious interest, is how they feel when they're around the people. And they became lifelong friends with a lot of the kids that they met and grew up with, you know, at retreats and various different things like that. So I think that's, you know, a really important thing, just to have the social contact.
A community, in other words, a sense of community.
Yes, and also not only just a community, but it's a special community, because my kids always found out that Urantia kids are not the same as the kids you go to school with. There's differences, you know.
Such as?
I think that what they found was that the kids were kinder and nicer and a little bit more open. And I think that's because they have that spiritual background as well, which you don't find in, you know, a normal public school or in the neighborhood.
I think that's a common experience that many kids have. I know that I certainly experienced that same phenomenon in the Colorado community. I don't have to speak for Paula. Paula.
Definitely.
Paula has just oodles of second generation stories there. So, I mean, that is a common experience. It's a wonderful thing. They all of a sudden realize there's a closeness and a relationship with those kids that goes deeper somehow. They don't know why necessarily, but there's some interesting relationships that develop.
Well, I think that they do know why. I think it's because they feel like they are really family. It's not a hypothetical family of God. It's a real family of God. They really do feel like they are on an eternal journey together.
And you know, being around the adults too, because, you know, the children are valued, you know. The other thing that my son has done for quite a few years is Truth Seekers, which has just been wonderful for him, for the young adults, young kids.
Oh, yes.
The young adult, you know, the young adults, yeah.
The teenagers,
absolutely.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's
because they're at that precarious place.
Mm-hmm.
What did you say, Debbie? I'm sorry.
Oh, I said, what did I say? I just said that, it was a wonderful experience for him, and he's still friends with those people. You know, I see that with Yayas too. The Yayas are doing a great job.
Yeah, they
indeed.
Sure are.
Are they ever?
We've had them on the show, and they're all, you know, second generation Urantia book readers, all of them. And we're hoping that some of them might call in and just give us some insight in this series. We've asked them to, so hopefully they will. It would be nice to get a firsthand experience. But you know, we all have those stories. And Debbie, what you said reminded me of how hard it is when you raise a child with the concepts of the Urantia book and then they go to public school and they say something that's really odd and people look at them funny. And my daughter, my own daughter, when she was about 10, my oldest, Jean, she just celebrated her 39th birthday. She came home one day and she said, "Mom, it isn't easy being a Urantia kid." And I said, "Why, honey, why do you say that?" And she said, "Well, because these kids were saying how the devil's going to get you and hurt you." And I said, "Nuh-uh, he can't hurt you. He's on a prison world." And I said to her, "What did you say? Or what did they say?" And she said, "They just looked at me really funny." And, you know, that is the challenge, that, you know, you have to kind of teach them, well, you know, don't say some of those things, because out of context, those things seem really strange. And yet, you know, when someone says to your child, "Hey, you're going to hell," one of my son-in-law had an experience where he was told he was going to hell, and it was very, very traumatic for him as a child. I mean, it was like a pivotal moment in his childhood. He had some trauma around it. And so, you know, you want to be able to counter that with something really positive to say, "No, that's not the God we know."
Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, it can be challenging then to some of the concepts come out. Another story I heard once from a good friend in Arizona, her son went to school and he was a first grader, I think, and he came home and he said, "Mom, today the teacher was talking about creation, and she asked if any of us knew about creation, and I raised my hand, and I said, 'Yeah, you know, about wonton and fonton.'"
Wonton and fonton, that's great.
And his mom said to him, "Well, what did she say?" And he said, "She just said, 'What religion are you again?'"
That's great. That's great. Could I have lo mein with that?
And they also went to conferences, you know, most of their lives here and there, you know. But we did, we missed the whole thing, like Boulder, because we're, you know, fairly isolated. There aren't that many kids around here. So they didn't have, you know, that everyday community of kids to believe in, you know, to hang out with and stuff like that. But I have to say, when they were, you know, 5 years old, we did have thought adjuster parties where for each kid I would take them out into the woods. Aww. And we'd have a picnic and we'd, you know, welcome the thought adjuster into their lives. So we did kind of make a ritual around that, which I think was pretty cool.
Very cool.
Yeah, you know, and we went out into nature to do that, you know, with a picnic and... So that was pretty neat. But as far as how much of readers they are and things now, you know, it's really hard to tell because they grew up with the concepts that were just part of their everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
And where they take that, you know, is really up to them, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
See, I think that's a really good point.
And one of the things that we were just talking about yesterday, Andre and I, was that, you know, everybody seems to have a certain age where they, and for a lot of us it seemed to be, you know, right when we were done with college. Or we have some other pivotal time in our young adulthood where we realize that our spiritual development really is a personal choice and something we need to attend to, and we begin to seriously study the teachings for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Angie Thurston was on a few weeks ago, and she talked about that experience in her life as well. Even growing up in a study group for children where they actually read through the book, she still had to decide for herself at a pivotal age that this was something she needed to read for herself and make up her own mind about whether or not this was what she believed in.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I did with my kids when they were younger was we went to Sunday school in, you know, traditional Christian churches. I would church hunt until I found the one that I liked, but my idea was that I wanted them to have some foundation in, you know, traditional Christianity, and also to realize that it wasn't just mom who talked about God, but that other people did as well, and so they had a church community of people as well. And I think that was really beneficial because we would also talk about, you know, this is what they said in church, and, well, this is what the Urantia book says about that. So I was trying to teach them, you know, to be a little discerning, you know, to not just take it as blanket truth, but to, you know, think about it. And I would tell them, you know, the things that I didn't agree with and why and stuff like that. So, you know, just a little comparative, you know, religious studies, but also to give them a community of, you know, God-believing people as well.
Yeah,
that's how my parents felt as well. They thought it was really important. Sorry, Paula, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I just was saying that's a great reasoning. I mean, I really appreciate that because if they don't hear other people having faith, that's kind of a foundation right there.
My dad also felt like it was important for us to be grounded in a popular culture, you know, in a culture that, you know, would help us to know and understand our peers.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time in the early to mid 60s, families were still going to church. And growing up in a mission community, of course, everybody was very churched. And even in boarding school, I had an experience of nightly devotions, which was actually a much more positive experience for me than church was, because it was something that we had control of. We got to decide, you know, kind of what the topic was, and we would get to choose Bible verses and choose hymns. And choosing of the hymns was the thing that we really loved to do.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a way for us to be somewhat more familiar with what those around us believed, as well as what it said in the Urantia book.
I think it's important for kids to know what traditional Christianity is about, because I don't think you can make informed decisions unless you have the information too. And it's good to have the information. And we would, you know, well, I wouldn't take them around Easter time. We would just kind of miss church those weeks, but and you know, discuss it afterwards. But you know, and they became friends with other kids who are also at the church too, which I think was important as well. So.
Well, it is important, and, you know, my kids went to Awana's, and that was, they grew up in the mountains outside of Boulder, one of the communities, incidentally, that's been pretty heavily hit by the flood, and we were up there for 23 years. Both of my kids grew up there, and there was a pretty fundamental Christian church up there. And my children went to that church for a while through the Awana's program. And I remember at one point we went to, you know, I used to ask them, okay, so what do you think? What did you hear? And it was really cute. You know, their kids are motivated by different things, and they like the desserts that they got at Awana's. And they had to learn a Bible verse, and so then they could have dessert. And we went to a presentation one night, and it was maybe at Easter time, actually. And the presentation was a puppet show and the little lamb who was very frightened because he was going to be the sacrifice. And the other little lambs came to him and said, "Don't be afraid, you're like Jesus." And my mind I think my head tried to explode. I couldn't get out of that church fast enough.
Oh,
and
dear.
Yeah. And of course, though, you know, on the other side of that was a great opportunity to have a really good conversation with my kids
mm-hmm.
about this concept of sacrifice. And is that really how God is? Does God really expect a shedding of blood? Is that what you really believe about God? And of course,
mm-hmm.
they were about, you know, 11 and 8, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to admit, no.
Didn't really work.
Didn't really work.
The other thing I did with my kids when they turned 13 on their 13th birthday, they each got their own Urantia book. And just kind of as another little ritual, you know. So they all have their own, you know, personal books. And whether they read them is up to them, but they all have their own book. And I, you know, wrote little things in it and stuff that were applicable to each child. But...
That's
well, Debbie, you make some interesting points. So one of the points that you made about the kids getting to recognize that you're not the only one talking about God, one way that was expressed by my daughter just recently, she's now in her 20s, and she's an emergent Christian in the Seattle area, and regularly attends her church and, in fact, regularly participates and teaches in the Bible study and you know, participating in those activities. And one of the things that she shared was in terms of a recent dating experience. She'd been dating a guy for about 3 months, and she's just kind of cluing in that she maybe should be asking more on the front end, you know, what these guys, you know, believe or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, she said, do your parents, did they ever talk to you about God? Or, do you ever think about God? And he all of a sudden apparently clammed up. And, I mean, whereas the conversation had been flowing pretty well, she encountered about a 15-second pause. And at that point,
mm-hmm.
she knew something wasn't quite right. And for her, the way she grew up, God was discussed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something, you talk about it as much as you talk about, you know, going to the store, going to the movies, whatever else, talking about your relationship with God because you have that real and present in your life. And so... You know, I, as we were talking, I said, well, you know, so maybe that's something, you know, you talk about earlier, you know, with these guys. And she said, yeah, I think so, you know, because that was kind of strange, you know. And but that is a difference. It's not really... clear, I think, to a lot of us how uncomfortable a lot of people and what the actual, say, average is in terms of society, in terms of their comfort talking about God and talking about religion, because we get used to talking with people in the Urantia community, whether they believe, whether they don't believe, all the time. We just understand that it's something
yeah.
we talk about, and we don't talk about it as well, and this, I think, is the key from a proselytizing kind of point of view. We talk about it as though it's real for us, because it is, but we don't talk about it as though it's something that people have to do themselves, but we raise questions. And
well,
I think that
you know,
gets into the kids.
And something else that has come to my attention, too, in recent times, my grandmother was deeply a spiritual mentor to me in my life, and deeply faithful in a quiet, non-dogmatic way. I mean, she just had a deep and abiding faith, and she had no problem talking about God or Jesus, but not in dogmatic ways. You know what I mean? Much more in faithful ways. And so I was really open to conversations about God. And I think what happens is people get shut down because they feel judged. Of all things, I think I've come to the conclusion that of all the things we could do to somebody that will shut them down faster than anything is to make them feel judged. make them feel like they've been assessed and are found unworthy. I mean, it just goes to the very core of human need, the need to be accepted for who you are.
Yeah.
And to think that even God doesn't accept you. what a tragic thing that is. I mean, to start out life as a unique human being and, you know, and then run into this thing, well, okay, but there's these rules, and if you don't follow them, God, you know, you don't get any of the good stuff that God has to offer because you are not acceptable.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's what shuts people down. I think that's why they're afraid to talk about God, because they really don't want to hear that they're not acceptable again. And and that's really sad. That makes me sad. I think when someone is hesitant to talk about it, then that's because somewhere along the line they've heard something that shut them down.
And you know, you bring up an interesting point that way. I mean, that can be the open door to discussing, you know, things about the nature of God when a topic like that comes up. Because I mean, it doesn't take much reflection, I think, even for a child to realize, well, you know, kiddo, God made you, right? Uh-huh. Well, do you think just 5 years after the project started, you think he's made junk? You think he made a mistake? You know, I mean, kids can be impressed with the idea that, no, wait a minute, God could not possibly be that kind of sandcastle God who makes a sandcastle, doesn't like how it turns out, and starts kicking it down. God would have to have a lot more insight and foresight, you know, to be the kind of God that is worthy of the name God, is worthy of being
worthy
all-powerful.
Of your worship.
Right, yeah. I mean, all power must go with all love. I mean, that's a lesson out of the Urantia book, but it's not because it's in the Urantia book that I think people believe it. I think we believe what's in the Urantia book because our inner spiritual experience resonates with that. And we say, well, of course it's got to be that way. It has to be that way. How could it be that this God could be so immature, so cantankerous, so fraught
petty
with fits of, you know, oh, I don't like what I did anymore. Damn you to hell. You know? I mean, for goodness sake, you know, there's got to be a little more foresight than that on God's part. And kids can get that. Little kids can get that. It's only, you know, brainwashed adults that have trouble with that idea.
Well, and that is a great launching off place for where I was sort of hoping to start the show today, which is this idea that there are several years in your children's lives where they automatically respect you.
Oh, no.
And for people who believe that waiting until your kids are teenagers, when they're old enough to think and reason and to think for themselves and reason things out, and that's sort of when they should approach sharing the Urantia teachings with them. That's where I really kind of have to say, ho there, wait a minute. You guys are really missing an amazing opportunity if you're going to wait until your kids are older.
Yeah, I think you need to start, you know, it's just part of life. God's love is part of life, so you start it the time they're born.
Indeed.
Yeah.
I told my grandson that he has God in his heart, and he's such a Godzilla fan that since he was a little tiny guy, he's been watching Godzilla. He just, something about Godzilla fascinates him, so he went home and told his mom, my daughter, that he has Godzilla in his heart.
That's great.
But you know, that's okay, because that's a place to start, and I could actually get a lot of great concepts about God in using what he likes about Godzilla. So But Crystal, yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, I was just
going to
say that does sound a little bit more like the God that a lot of other people believe in.
Yeah.
The fire-breathing God.
Right.
But that's a great jumping off point for saying you've got courage, kid. You've
yeah,
got courage, and it's right in you.
And I did actually get to tell him that God
is... I'll hang up now and let's take your other caller.
Okay.
Well, Debbie, thank you so much for calling
in. You're
welcome
to stay with us, Deb, if you wish, but thank you so much for calling.
Actually, I think the reason we were getting the echo is because your phone was on there twice somehow.
Oh,
and
okay.
So, yeah, so it was actually not two callers, it was you, but you were showing up twice. So that's where that force, the echo came through in the forest there.
Okay. Well, nice talking to you.
You
nice
too
talking
for calling
you.
A wonderful
thank you for
weekend.
Calling in.
Okay, bye-bye.
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 So, Crystalyn, you were hoping to make the point that it's never too early to start teaching concepts of God, and I wholeheartedly agree with you, because young children can feel vulnerable in the world. I think we forget how visceral is their fear sometimes. And how vulnerable they can feel. You know, children are afraid of the dark, for instance. Children are afraid of what's under the bed. Children can have a lot of unreasoned fear.
Mm-hmm.
And this concept that they're watched over by you know, the magnificent and friendly forces of creation that we've come to know and love because of the Urantia book.
Well, my daughter had a lot of fear about going to bed. She had a lot of fear of the dark. And, you know, she came from a place where she had, in some cases, something to fear. She did have it wasn't an unreasoned fear. She actually did have something to fear because they lived in an area where they were really likely to be under attack during a period of time in South Africa's history when they were going through the transition from apartheid to more of a free government. And
mm-hmm.
What happened there was that almost all of the people who were incarcerated were let out of prison after the fall of apartheid. And it suddenly did become a very risky place for the whites. And there was a lot of backlash.
Hmm.
And so a little white girl wasn't really safe out on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she was never able to go outside of their walled-in courtyard to play. It was something that was probably impressed upon her fairly early on in her life,
mm-hmm.
that she needed to be very, very careful. She needed to be afraid. So we had quite a bit of a challenge trying to get her to sleep in her own bed for those first few years that she was here. And she was slowly coming out of that fear-based thinking. But it took a while. And it was so helpful to me to use the concepts of her guardian angels watching over her.
Mm.
You know, and that there were unseen friends that she could count on being there for her and protecting her. And I frequently used the line you had shared with me some years previously, that when you came to the realization that the angels loved your kids even more than you did.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. And, you know, here I always pray to them, you know, to watch over my children almost incessantly. And I got back a very clear message, well, we love them too. And that led me to
mm-hmm.
realize just how much they do and how many centuries they've you know, they've watched over beautiful children on this planet and nurtured them and wanted to help them grow in good and positive ways and healthy ways. And imagine what we can do to help them in that mission. You know,
yeah.
They're on the case already. Imagine if parents reinforce that beautiful concept, how much more we can do. And Mei Li, I've got to say, my youngest, you know, I didn't hold, no holds barred there. You know, Mei is from China, and she grew up early on hearing how the moment we knew we were going to go to China to get a baby, we started praying to the angels and telling them, please, angels, you know, we know you know the perfect baby for us. And so, you know, so she's grown up with this concept from the get-go. For, you know, we've told her all along about the angels, and this concept of angels is very, very comforting to children, I think, Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, some time ago, oh gosh, probably 10 years ago when she was about 7, I told her about the 1111, that 1111 loyal secondary midwayers who worked tirelessly on our world for spiritual progress. And I told her the whole story about the midwayers. In fact, I've gone to great lengths to tell all of my children about them. And so at 11, she for years she set her little watch. She wore a wristwatch and she with an alarm, and she'd set it to 11:11, and then when it would go off, she'd say a little prayer.
Goodness, wow! that's an interesting and a very you know, helpful kind of a what do you call it, spiritual technique, or a technique of bringing about a spiritual thought. That kind of spiritual reminder, wonderful idea. And she came up with that on her own. That's marvelous.
Well, and I had told her, you know, when you see 1111 or 555 or 444 or 333, you know, it's a little prompt, it's a little spiritual reminder to tune into our unseen friends and our spirit helpers on this world and thank them for their tireless efforts on our behalf. And so she went one step further. I won't wait till I see it. I'll remind myself to do it. And
yeah.
It was really cute. Yeah, she came up with that. So, but it just goes to show that if you bring it to their attention, and your point is so well taken, Crystal, in that when they're small, they're open to, and even though, like, I've noticed some resistance with my grandson, you know, well, I don't know, Grandma, I really like Godzilla, you know. And how, you know, mm-hmm. how does God weigh up to Godzilla? And it gives me the perfect opportunity to say, well, Godzilla really respects God.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets that. And there's a God bigger than, you know, any of those concepts.
Yeah.
And he gets that. So, you know, I think that rather we need to challenge ourselves and not give up, because now my grandson, he's totally on board with that. He'll say things like, yeah, that's like God, right, Grandma? Or Jesus would know that, right? Yeah, that's right.
That's marvelous. That's any time we help a child to develop a spiritual reaction pattern like that, or an innate spiritual habit pattern like that, it's such a blessing, because there are so many other distractions in life. You know, goodness, one of the things in the news lately, that'll put a date marker on this show, but people will be aware that there was a piece of gaming software that just sold in 48 hours, sold $1 billion in that is one of the most violent pieces of software that is competing for our children's attention. And anything that a parent can do to give them a way to remind themselves of other things, of their spiritual connectedness, that makes sense. And is essential. It's essential for navigating this life that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
So while we're on that topic, I'd like to share that you know, there are all kinds of things from the Urantia book that we can get and present to our children. One thing that I presented to my kids on their 2,134th day of life, some of you there will automatically recognize that number. That is spoken of in the Urantia book as the average day on which a thought adjuster arrives. So we know that not everybody's thought adjuster arrives on that day. But if you're average or slightly above, you know that by then your thought adjuster would have arrived. So I took that opportunity with my kids to celebrate Adjuster Day with them. And I planned for each of them to have their very own adjuster spot that would be a place of reflection, not necessarily one that they would go to all the time, but that in later life they'd be aware that this was where they were brought to as a special place to celebrate, you know, the genesis of their soul. Because, of course, when the thought adjuster comes, that is the sign that the soul has incepted. It's the thought adjuster who's incepting that soul upon that child's first moral choice. And, you know, creating those kinds of opportunities for kids to have as anchor points in their life that they can go back to. My son, I took him up to Kenosha Pass, and right on the other side of Kenosha Pass is a wonderful overlook of what in Colorado we know to be South Park, not the show, what the show is based on, loosely. And it's a beautiful, beautiful vista of a magnificent, open, rolling sort of plain in the mountains, surrounded by mountains. And that's my son's adjuster spot. And another place up there near Grand, Colorado, a forested creek spot was where I took my daughter Vanessa, and I took my daughter Ivana a little closer to home to a park just in the neighborhood, because we weren't able to get out of town that day. I think my car was on the fritz or something, but I made do with a park that was in the neighborhood, and that became her adjuster spot. And I don't know that they'll ever go back. I don't know. You know, we have gone back. Actually, as kids, I would drive up there with the kids or go for a walk. But what they do in adult life, I'm not sure. How they ever remember it, I'm not sure. But it was something that functions as an anchor point to let them know that somehow on that day, God did come to indwell them. And they do remember that. It's made that concept solid for them.
I love that, because, you know, it's like the Urantia book talking about Jesus while he was dying on the cross, going back in his mind to that place of Galilee where he was always mm-hmm. at peace, where he was always loved and accepted, and it gave him comfort. And oftentimes, you know, you can associate a place of peace and beauty with the deep spiritual idea. And I think that's wonderful, Andre. Beautiful. To give them that, you know, of course, the book reiterates that the beauty of nature. And Crystal, I know you did quite a bit of research on quotes. Did you find that one about, you know, take children out into nature?
I didn't. So why don't you go ahead and read that, if you can pull it up.
Well, I have to find it first. But
well, if we just, I was looking at the things and the government on a neighboring planet. So while you're looking for that, I thought I would bring that up. It just says, this is from paper 72, section 3. It says, these people regard the home as the basic institution of their civilization. It is expected that the most valuable part of a child's education and character training will be secured from his parents and at home. And fathers devote almost as much attention to child culture as do mothers.
Mm-hmm.
All sex instruction is administered in the home by parents or by legal guardians. Moral instruction is offered by teachers during the rest periods in the school shops, but not so with religious training, which is deemed to be the exclusive privilege of parents. Religion being looked upon as an integral part of home life. Purely religious instruction is given publicly only in the temples of philosophy. No such exclusively religious institutions as the Urantia churches having developed among this people. In their philosophy, religion is the striving to know God and to manifest love for one's fellows through service for them. But this is not typical of the religious status of the other nations on this planet. Religion is so entirely a family matter among these people that there are no public places devoted exclusively to religious assembly. Politically, church and state, as Urantians are wont to say, are entirely separate, but there is a strange overlapping of religion and philosophy. Until 20 years ago, the spiritual teachers, comparable to Urantia pastors, who visit each family periodically to examine the children to ascertain if they've been properly instructed by their parents, were under government supervision. These spiritual advisors and examiners are now under direction of the newly created Foundation of Spiritual Progress, an institution supported by voluntary contributions. Possibly, this institution may not further evolve until after the arrival of a paradise magisterial son. Anyway, the thing that moved me about that quote was that, you know, this was, although there was no formal institution for religion, these were determined to be so important of a parental responsibility that it's even overseen by this other public entity.
Wow.
And so while the Urantia book says that we shouldn't give our kids ready-made sort of dogmatic
religious experience,
I think it's very different than saying that we shouldn't be giving our children any religious training.
Very different. Yeah, it's not to be taken that way at all. And I think the experience of people that have raised their kids with or without. I mean, we had Debbie. It was just wonderful to hear from her, and many of us got to see her at Yosemite when we were there just a few weeks ago. Goodness.
Mm-hmm.
But I digress. you know, to share that with us was wonderful. That's a good positive example. And we've had friends in the movement who've shared that they have deliberately waited with their kids with not so positive results, with the result that the kids were not interested, and in adolescent and later adult life, there wasn't an easy way to get them interested anymore. That time had passed. So I think that's a good point. And Paul, I just wanted to point out, I found that quote for you.
I saw that. I found it too, but go ahead.
I found it too.
No, go ahead.
I found it three.
It's the triple pet play. Well,
dang.
Here, I'll read part of that paragraph.
I want to say before you read it, it's got such a great number for this paragraph to remember where this is. It's in paper 167.66.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? 167.6.6. And the paper is The Visit to Philadelphia. When it is not possible to worship God in the tabernacles of nature, men should do their best to provide houses of beauty, sanctuaries of appealing simplicity and artistic embellishment, so that the highest of human emotions may be aroused in association with the intellectual approach to spiritual communion with God. Truth, beauty, and holiness are powerful and effective aids to true worship, but spirit communion is not promoted by mere massive ornateness and overmuch embellishment with man's elaborate and ostentatious art. Beauty is most religious when it is most simple and nature-like. How unfortunate that children should have their first introduction to concepts of public worship in cold and barren rooms, so devoid of the beauty appeal and so empty of all suggestion of good cheer and inspiring holiness. The child should be introduced to worship in nature's outdoors and later accompany his parents to public houses of religious assembly, which are at least as materially attractive and artistically beautiful as the home in which he is daily domiciled. You know, it's just classic Urantia book right there. You know, they just lay it right out there. And you know, that idea that, for me, that touches home so much, Andre, because like your story of going out with your children to someplace beautiful in nature, when I was young, my dad had such an abiding respect for the mountains and their beauty. And so did my grandmother. And so he would say to me, "Paula, you want to go on a picnic?" And I'd say, "Oh, yeah." He'd say, "Let's call Grandma and get her to pack a picnic lunch and we'll all go up." So he would call her, and I mean, in an hour, she had a picnic because we were all so keen to go. And once we got there, we would throw out the blanket, and the three of us, and she's the spiritual grandmother I was mentioning earlier, and so obviously my dad had that. I got that from both of them. I can feel it coming to me in such a strong vein. And we would throw out the blanket, and we would sit down in nature, and we would immediately become reverent. Immediately. Hmm. And we would get silent. We wouldn't talk. We would just soak in the beauty of nature and the sounds and the smells, everything. Mm-hmm. It was an immediate reverence. You didn't even have to speak of it. So that was very, very special. And I think we all experience that if we go into nature. I mean, we certainly, the three of us, had a double dose of that recently in Yosemite, didn't we?
Oh, yeah.
It was just amazing.
Wasn't that the truth, that we felt that awe just naturally? I mean, there wasn't any real need to prompt people to worship.
Mm-mm.
No. I mean, those trees tower around you like cathedral spires or a great colonnade, but unlike cathedral spires or a great colonnade, they're not cold, they're warm and living and beautiful. And
inviting.
And inviting, and it's just a marvelous natural place to worship. It's marvelous that they simply, in this paragraph, you know, lead us to an idea that is simple. It's not like this is anything earth-shattering. What's earth-shattering is that we don't think about this on its own, on our own very often. That it takes it being pointed out to us for us to say, well, of course that's true. That's been my experience. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't I have said that?
But you intrinsically knew
it. But the fact
knew
is, it takes that kind of reflection to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a very reflective paragraph.
And isn't it true that the beauty of nature just kind of immediately gets you there? So if you live in a place where there's a lot of natural beauty, you're in tune in a way. You kind of, it keeps it in your consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah, you're both grounded, but I like the way you put it, that, you know, you lay down the blanket in nature. You sit down, and all of a sudden, all your senses are alive. with the smell of the air, the flowers, the grass, whatever is around you, and you're looking around and maybe you hear a babbling brook, you know, that's literally just babbling away in the background, and all of a sudden you're soothed and you get quiet and you start noticing all the sounds, the crickets chirping and the birds tweeting, and it's just wonderful. You know, you then soak it in, and you naturally go to a place where you wonder, goodness, how did this all come about? How lucky I am, how fortunate I am, and begin to get thoughts of thankfulness.
And gratitude.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Boy, great description, Andre. I went there in my mind just as you were describing it. That was beautiful.
Well,
of course,
you know, I have to just make a short commercial plug for that experience that we had in Yosemite. It was really pretty spectacular, really being able to have that worshipful experience in nature, in one of the great cathedrals of nature.
Amazing.
You really can see how that place in the world inspires people to deep philosophic thought and reverence, and how someone like John Muir could be so moved by the beauty in that space to begin to promote this national park or national the whole national park concept.
Right. Yeah, you know, Glenn and May love to climb 14,000-foot mountains together. And I just know from talking to her that that's a spiritual experience for her.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it is for him. I mean, oh, my. Our dear friend Mo has climbed every 14,000-foot mountain in Colorado. And it was a burning passion. It isn't just about getting to the top of mountains. I don't think people climb mountains just to get to the top. I think it's about what happens when they get there.
Mm-hmm.
The view they have, the feeling they get, the feeling of achievement, but not only that, the beauty, the feeling of being able to see for who knows how far.
Mm-hmm.
And the reverence they get and the clarity. It's a very spiritual experience for them, and it's something May and Glenn share, and I'm so pleased for them that they have that. It's been quite a while since I've climbed a 14,000-foot mountain. I did climb a couple of them with him. It's not an easy thing to do, but once they get up there, they immediately have that reverent experience, and that's really what it's about. And they commemorate it. They take a picture, the two of them on top. The date. May always makes a little sign. And they've really gotten about taking their friends up there. May always documents the whole thing. It's just a real special thing for her. And I'm so glad she shares that with her dad. And he's so glad she shares it with him. You know, so, yeah,
well,
nature is.
Go ahead.
Well, nature's our advocate. That's just what I was going to say. We have a tremendous built-in advocate to get children to a very deep spiritual place, and that is the beauty of nature.
Yeah. So we can take advantage of that at any time. And, you know, that was an important experience as well of the kids growing up. It can be as simple as taking a family trip to the national parks, which, incidentally, as a plug for the national parks, I can say that there has never been a national park in the United States nor in Canada that has ever disappointed me. they are picked for a reason, and they're picked usually because in nature there is something about them that is unique, and they're well worth seeing. It's not your typical vista in that region, and when you're in that kind of a place, you feel all of a sudden like you've been transported in a way to another world, or at least a very special part of the world that you're on. And, you know, that is remarkable. So, you know, in that regard, I know I speak for all of us in plugging and thanking again our wonderful organizer of that experience, Deanne LeBrec, who's been on our show a number of times and who has organized the Urantia, the United Urantia Family Festival. You know, but for her organization and all the help of you, Crystalline, and many others that were on her committee, that experience would not have been available to us. So thank you to her, and thank you to all of you that helped to make that a possible experience. It really, truly, I think, shines in everyone's memory as an anchor point, as one of those spiritual anchor points in life that we'll always remember. I'll remember all of the relationships that deepened there. I got to know Terry McCade much better, and got to visit outside the balcony. Oh, my goodness gracious. You know, just loved that. And I got to see Suzanne Bacalish, who, you know, regularly has been, you know, following our program here. And it's been marvelous to meet a lot of the people that actually tune in, you know, to the show, but not for that reason. It's always wonderful to meet, as Jesus so aptly put, to gain it on one occasion. Isn't it wonderful to meet a new brother or sister?
It is. It is indeed. You know, because the family just keeps growing. It's a cosmic family, and it grows in the heart of brothers and sisters. It grows in each of our hearts to the degree that we allow ourselves to take in a new brother or sister. And and really that's what cosmic citizenship is about. And it's so important to instill that in children. And I loved Debbie's comment about how, you know, her children noticed that Urantia children were more friendly, more open.
Nicer,
and that's you know, in a way that bespeaks the love of the open hearts, the way that the book just opens your heart and gives you that perspective, a cosmic perspective, that it's okay, you know, whatever condition we humans are going through right now at this moment, it gets better, and we're all kind of acting out of a place of all we know, you know, whatever that is, and you know, we have to get to a higher place, and so we help our children get there. And I'm really encouraged by young people. I find that they are much less willing to entertain ideas of hate and prejudice. I think, you know, overall, young people are and the Urantia book reiterates this, that evolution is a given, and we can count on it, and they will get to that place.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. You know, in our generation in the United States and Canada, and I think in a lot of places in the first world, if not other places in the world, there is that kind of evolution that's going on in the younger generation where all of a sudden, no matter where you are in the country, it's very rare for racism or anything like that to even be a concept, let alone be present. The kind of openness that people have to the differences in other people today, it was just not present when some of us were growing up two generations ago. And
it's amazing how quickly things have changed.
Yes.
With the right kind of conceptual framework for children, much progress has been made.
Right.
Which, you know, really is a great way to support the concept of this show. You know, the fact that you can make such cultural progress in a short time with education.
Right. And it's not a matter that large numbers of people necessarily have to be brought along directly in the first wave in order for that culture somehow or pieces of that culture to disseminate. You know, the entire Urantia book and its philosophy and culture are not there in the world yet. However, what the world is ready for, some things that have been talked about in the Urantia book somehow are remarkably appearing in the world. And part of that is that tolerance and acceptance. Now, is that just happening on its own, or is the Urantia book starting to have some of that effect? I'm sure there are other things having an effect, but by goodness, you know, things that I read, 20 years ago or more in the Urantia book are starting to come to pass in terms of what we're beginning to see among certain groups of people. And it's spreading. That kind of tolerance is spreading, even if we find all kinds of examples of intolerance still. It's as it was.
What you're saying just reminds me of something so beautiful that really touched my heart lately. And, you know, I'd love to get this fellow on the show, if we could get him on the show. His name is Rani Edry. He's from Israel. And he's a young person. He has a young wife and a baby. And I think what you're describing, Andre, is the signs of the spiritual springtime that Jesus spoke of when he spoke about when he would return. Anyway, Rani Edry started a campaign called I Love You, Iran. And it starts out, and if you guys will indulge me, I'd just love to read this because it's so indicative of what you're talking about.
I love him and what he's done.
The natural
spread all over the world.
It is. He says to the Iranian people, to all the fathers, mothers, children, brothers, and sisters. For there to be a war between us, first we must be afraid of each other. We must hate. I am not afraid of you. I don't hate you. I don't even know you. No Iranian ever did me any harm. I never even met an Iranian. Just one in Paris in a museum. Nice dude. I see sometime here on the TV an Iranian. He is talking about war. I'm not sure he does not represent all the people of Iran. If you see someone on your TV talking about bombing you, be sure he does not represent all of us. I'm not an official representative of my country, but I know the streets of my town. I talk with my neighbors, my families, my friends. And in the name of all these people, we love you. We mean you no harm. On the contrary, we want to meet you, have some coffee, and talk about sports. To all those who feel the same, share this message and help it reach the Iranian people. And he's a graphic designer, and he did these posters, and they're all just, every poster says the same thing, only with a different graphic, I love you, Iran. And so they started sending these posters, he and his wife, and pretty soon more people were sending them. And the next thing you know, they're getting back posters from Iranian people, young people.
And they're all over Facebook.
I love you, Israel.
Wow.
It's so beautiful.
And it turned into a worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah.
Not just between Israel and Iran, but other countries started doing the same thing. And it turned into a whole movement.
And to tie it back to what we're talking about, somebody in this young man's life gave him a concept of God, who God really is, the love of God, the tolerance of God, the patience of God, the goodness of God. Somebody in this young Israeli's life gave him a real foundation to love even the person that somebody else says don't love them. They're no good. But he points out, I don't even know you. How can I hate you? I don't know you. I'm not afraid of you. And nobody's going to make me afraid of you. I love you. Let's have coffee. I love that.
Let's talk about sports.
Yeah. This is so basic. The religious, to give a child a religious foundation where they don't hate, where they're not afraid. It's just
where they really understand the concept of brotherly love and the concept of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, in my opinion, is not giving a kid
a ready-made mode of thinking. It is a basic spiritual truth concept. And if you believe that this book has any revelatory relevance, if you believe that it is what it says it is, and it is the fifth epical revelation, what does that mean? What does it mean for this to be the fifth epical revelation? How is an epical revelation different from auto-revelation or a religion of an evolutionary religious concept? What is the difference between that and what this book claims?
You know, Krystalyn, you've said that quote again, and maybe it behooves us to read that. It's from paper 100, Religion and Human Experience, and just take it in the context of, you know, it's paper 101, section 3, paragraph 3, section 1, paragraph 3, Religious Growth. It says, give every developing child a chance to grow his own religious experience. Do not force a ready-made adult experience upon him. Remember, year by year, progress through an established educational regime does not necessarily mean intellectual progress, much less spiritual growth. Enlargement of vocabulary does not signify development of character. Growth is not truly indicated by mere products, but rather by progress. Real educational growth is indicated by enhancement of ideas, increased appreciation of values, new meanings of values, and augmented loyalty to supreme values. Children are permanently impressed only by the loyalties of their adult associates. Precept or even example is not lastingly influential. Loyal persons are growing persons, and growth is an impressive and inspiring reality. Live loyally today, grow, and tomorrow will attend to itself. The quickest way for a tadpole to become a frog is to live loyally each moment as a tadpole. Now, that's just two paragraphs from that section, which most Urantia Book readers would tell you those papers are exquisite. The papers on
religion. They are really exquisite. I bet you nailed it right there. And, you know, so often a quote is taken out of context. And I think that is a really great example of one that is so frequently taken out of context.
Right.
Because if you read the entire paragraph, it gives you a much different feeling than the idea that you shouldn't train your children in religious, you know, development. You know,
right.
If you go on to paragraph 5 in that same section, it says, the soil essential for religious growth presupposes a progressive life of self-realization, the coordination of natural propensities. The coordination of natural propensities. The exercise of curiosity and the enjoyment of reasonable adventure, the experiencing of feelings of satisfaction, the functioning of fear stimulus of attention and awareness, the wonder lure and a normal consciousness of smallness, humility. Growth is also predicated on the discovery of selfhood accompanied by self-criticism, conscience. For conscience is really the criticism of oneself by one's own value habits, personal ideals.
Wow, what a great definition of conscience right there.
Well, and where you're taught, where this paragraph, in my opinion, this paragraph gives parents this fabulous launching pad for how to create this essential soil for religious growth. And this paragraph right here, frankly, is probably the foundation
of where what my dad used as a launching pad for introducing us to the concepts in the book. Because one by one, he took each of those types of experiences and brought into our imagination, into our family's collective imagination, concepts that would stimulate our longing for, our reaching for, our adventure lust for finding God and the experience of serving and loving our fellows. Also, it stimulated us to develop a self-critical conscience.
Which leads
to be
really
able to...
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to say, to be able to experience criticism in a way that was productive. We weren't punished necessarily for making mistakes or for reaching out and trying something new. But we were also, you know, given plenty of opportunity for reflection.
Right. And I'm just trying to point out, too, that one thing we want to talk about is how not creating some of these things can really be detrimental to a human being. And we have planned some quotes from Jude and the mistakes that his parents made, which are really counter to what this paragraph you just read says.
You mean
he
Judas?
He wasn't given a sense, or Judas, not Jude, sorry. Yeah, Judas. He wasn't given a sense of his smallness. His humility. He wasn't able to criticize his own value habits. He was given a sense of overmuch self-importance. So, yeah.
And
I think
a lot of people have overcompensated for the lack of self-esteem that was so much a part of previous religious teachings. And sort of a new agey idea of everything's okay and
right.
We're all perfect. And, you know, we just haven't woken up to realize our perfection.
I'm not going to proselytize the way I have been proselytized to, and I'm not going to subject my kids to the kind of brainwashing that I was subjected to. There's that kind of overreaction that can occur as well.
Uh-huh.
And as much as it's well motivated in the heart, it's not fully thought through and it's not fully in line with the truth of experience. Children need some precepts. They don't need to be bludgeoned to death with doctrine and dogma. And especially not the negative kinds of doctrine and dogma which drive a wedge between them and God. On the other hand, if there is something positive, a truth about God, by all means, that can be stated, and it doesn't have to be stated in that kind of high-handed or heavy-handed way, in the sense that truth is self-evident, especially to the mind of a child, if it's presented in a way that is simply gentle and normal. This idea of the tadpole that's brought to mind, it just brought to mind to me the idea that many of us as kids, you know, in our science classes, had tadpoles growing in the room becoming frogs. I don't know that everybody did, but it was common for me as a kid. And it strikes me that that's a really good experience for kids to watch things grow, whether it be plants, whether it be little animals, and that kind of thing. And when you see that, especially like a tadpole, that does, you know, rest as an analogy. Okay, so, you know, it took time. I wondered when that tail was going to shrink and drop off, and by gum, it eventually did. It took a lot longer that I thought it should, but eventually that did change. And lo and behold, later in life, you find out how fast those changes really do happen and how quickly life really does pass. But you know, those are things that do shine in your memory as wonderful living analogies that you can then apply to your own spiritual growth.
You know, it reminds me. Go ahead, Andre, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was just going to say, you know, I'm just thinking comically of how you know, teenage boys and young men will relate to, you know, when you're 12 and you first start having, you know, the possibility of chin hairs, and you wonder, when is that going to come in, you know? And then by the time you're an adult, you're saying, you mean I got to shave again? Oh, my goodness. You know, those kinds of experiences of growing are marvelous analogies for what we go through in spiritual growth.
Well, and what you were saying reminds me of Sarah Blackstock's story about Joy in the Worm Bin and how many spiritual lessons she and a group of children learned from just cultivating a worm bin. We have another caller, so I'm going to put our caller through here. They've been holding for a few minutes. Area code 252, or I'm sorry, 250. You're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, I'm good.
Hi,
how are you?
Hi. I'm doing very well. My name is Erin, and my mom started reading the Arantia book probably, I'm going to say, a few years before I was born. So okay. I was raised on it entirely.
Oh,
wow.
I wanted to kind of add my experience to the conversation, because she did an incredible job.
Oh, wonderful.
And
what stands out for you, Erin?
Well, what that kind of looked like was that we would attend Christian church off and on throughout my childhood, and so I would have the introduction and the foundation to the Christian faith, and then I would have the Arantia book stories added. So I was able to go to church and enjoy the community and enjoy that foundation with the premise that people mean really well. They don't have all the information. Here's some more stories. Here's some more information. Here's more to add.
Beautiful.
So I had a very strong faith foundation. And as an adult, what it's turned into is that I can go to church and enjoy it. I have a lot of friends who were raised in very fundamental faiths that are still traumatized from that. And I don't have any of that. I was able to marry into a Catholic family. And if I can just tell you what our wedding looked like, it gives you a pretty good idea, was we were married in the United Church with a Catholic priest co-officiating, jumped through all of the Catholic marriage prep hoops, so we are married under the Catholic Church, and we're able to write a prayer for grace in the ceremony that had the fruits of the Spirit and Urantia book stuff in it.
Wow.
Cool.
Yeah.
What part of the country did you grow up in?
I'm in Canada.
And
you're
part
in British
Canada?
Columbia. That's the same area code that we got an earlier call from.
Yeah,
I am in British Columbia. This is true.
Yeah. Well, and did you find that your experience in church growing up, were you able to, you probably had to keep your Urantia book, or let's say an overt discussion of the Urantia book out of it, but you were able to introduce concepts, or were you able to talk about the Urantia book openly?
I would talk about it openly when it came up. However, I never really found that kids really want to talk about religion, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to youth group and church camps, and as a, you know, 14-year-old going to church camp, you talk about boys, right? You do the sing songs and praying and stuff, but I found that it was much more of a community, and I always felt that that I actually had a bit of an added advantage because I was able to enjoy the Christian faith without the guilt.
I had a similar experience. I didn't have the same kind of really negative experience that a lot of people did with Christianity because I had it balanced with Urantia book teachings.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and now I find, as an adult, I mean, I work full time in healing, and I counsel people of multiple faiths, and I'm able to relate to people of multiple faiths because of my foundation, right? Like,
wow.
I still have that foundation that I can meet people where they're at, and that's been a total gift.
And didn't you find that it was a wonderful advantage to grow up not being afraid
yeah.
of the things that those around you were afraid of?
Absolutely. Yeah, I didn't have any of the insecurities around any of that stuff. But also having that foundation of faith and that foundation of spirituality, and very much coming from, like, I have a religious foundation, it allowed me to actually enter into my in-laws and into my marriage, who are very devout Catholic, very devout, that I was able to kind of meet them head on and with full confidence in my faith and full confidence that I knew exactly what faith meant and we're good, even though I'm not Catholic and don't want to be.
I love that because, you know, I have a similar experience, Erin, in that I don't apologize to my faith for anybody.
No.
Or to anybody. I, you know, it is who I am. You either accept it or you don't. But I'm not going to rearrange myself. And so most of my relationships, they just accept it. They don't take issue with it. I'm not trying to cram it down anyone's throat. They know it's who I am. And I make it really clear, look, this is my faith, and this is my religious experience. Take it or leave it. I'm not going to hide it or try to pretend like it doesn't exist to keep it from offending you. You know, it's just not, it shouldn't even be an issue. And they understand that. I make it pretty clear. You know, if it comes up, if someone wants to judge me because of it, I make it pretty clear that I don't accept that. And we set some ground rules, and it's okay after that. You say you meet it head on, and I don't know if that's exactly what you mean, but that has really worked for me in terms of getting along with people who may not accept my faith, but they have to accept me because it is my experience. And
I find that what I mean in head on is literally just being, having the confidence and the strength in self to stand in my own without needing to people please or lie.
Yeah.
Right? That I can accept them where they're at and feel confident in myself and really see where at the heart of it and at the truth of it we're all looking for the same stuff. So there's always middle ground to meet on. Very much what allows me to meet people of any faith and work with them in helping them heal their life.
Yeah, I can really relate to what you're saying with that because I think a big part of being comfortable in your own skin is this idea that you really don't have to be afraid of being accepted or rejected by other people because your eternal situation is safe. In your own hands and in God's hands. You're not, I mean, one of the things I'm really grateful to for my dad was this idea that nobody else could ever interfere with my destiny or my spiritual progress other than me. And, you know, so the responsibility was laid squarely on my shoulders. And
absolutely.
But it didn't feel like an awesome weight. It felt like a very doable project.
It's liberating.
Oh, yeah, because in that sense, it's freeing.
Well, I love you sharing that, Erin, because, you know, I'm contrasting that, and you're bringing into mind the fact that you're calling from British Columbia is reminding me of the fact that, by God, I lived in British Columbia for 8 months of my life. I lived in the Fraser Canyon, just north of Hope and south of Lytton, B.C., and in the little town of, not Boston Bar, across from Boston Bar in North Bend. And when I lived there, I was just a young Urantia book reader at that point. I'd had the book for about a year and a half and mm-hmm. had gone through my first full reading. But I grew up Catholic, and so mm-hmm. I was living at that time surrounded by Church of Christ Christians and in that community. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I landed there because I had friends that were Church of Christ Christians. And I would talk to them about the Urantia book, but my experience was being unsettled, feeling unsettled all the time. I would still talk to them. I would still, be true to my convictions and all of that. And I didn't need to lord it over them or anything like that, but there was always this tension that was there within me because the early programming I'd had was so different. It was this programming of guilt and all of that stuff. And so I was just getting out of that. You can take the boy out of Catholicism, but it's pretty hard to take the Catholicism out of the boy. Mm. And
indeed.
And so what I marvel at is in second generation readers like you that have grown up with the book, what we're seeing is that the baggage, the programming that a lot of us got is completely unnecessary. You are living testament to the fact that you can have a relationship with God and you don't have to be scared into it. You can just be loved into that relationship with God, and you'll hold to that relationship with God.
Yeah.
And that is so wonderful to see. Thank you so much for sharing.
Yeah, my mom did a very good job there. And
bravo.
I mean, I can
to
go
your
to the Catholic
mom.
Church, right? I'll go to the Catholic Church with my in-laws. I'll go with my husband. We kind of flip back and forth between United and Catholic. And I can enjoy it and appreciate it and respect it.
Oh, I love that. That is a true interfaith value. And we, Aaron, I invite you to hold on. We have another caller. Do you want to hang on here with us?
I better get back to work, actually.
Okay, well, God bless you, darling. Thanks for calling. It was
just
wonderful
day.
To have you. You too.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
See ya. That was great hearing from Aaron. Area code 214.
And we're down to our last 8 minutes on the Cosmic Citizen.
We are. We've got another caller. Isn't that great? Area code 214, you're with us on the Cosmic Citizen.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, David in Dallas.
Hi,
David in Dallas.
Glad to meet you all out in Yosemite.
Yeah, that was wonderful, wasn't it?
Oh, super. Hey, I ran a gamut out there, went from Matthew Cartwright, is telling me how a shaman taught him to talk to a rock, to Jeff Waddles, who taught me that the Father's a recycler of souls, so that goes all the way from the first to the ninth dimension. along with what we're doing, some real-time use of this, my daughter, 41 years old, graduated last February in an intensive care unit, liver failure. She was in a coma.
Aww.
And as you know, I got started in the Urantia book last year, but the concepts were what I already believe from having, lived spiritual truth for a couple of decades. Now, I was able to work with her for about 6-8 months because she knew it was coming. And her problem was the I'm not good enough thing, after I die. I'm not good enough. I've made mistakes. I've had failures of this and that. And through using the concepts of the Urantia book, Fatherhood of God, the Brotherhood of Man, I was able to work with her and get past that, and convey this, wait a minute, hold it, I'm your father. Have I ever condemned you for anything? I'll point out where you're going wrong, but I'm not going to condemn you.
Right.
Or abandon her.
That's right. So I said, the only thing that counts, and which comes out of the Urantia book, is when you still have the presence of mind to decide to do the will of God. That's it. That's what he cares about. And she agreed with me and her thought adjuster when I explained that, and God, that she was willing to do the will of God. She wanted to do it. She was trying to do it. She was working on it up until when she went into the coma. And I'm certain we allayed all that fear. And as a matter of fact, I'm getting signs that, you know, she's still working with me from the other side now.
Aww.
You know?
Well, you know, isn't that a gift? My gosh, what a beautiful gift that is to be able to give your child at the end of her life. You know, here we are talking about children, and we tend to think that's all about when they're small and when they're growing up. But it really brings home the point, Dave, that you can minister to your child at any time, at
that
any
is true.
Age. And you had that great gift, that great privilege of being able to help your child overcome her fear of inadequacy at the end of her life. Wow, how sweet that is. I mean, it's sad, but it's sweet.
Right.
And, you know.
And as an extra with this, all of her friends from high school, college, were up there at the end, and I was ministering, you know, to them through her, even though she was in a coma that time. So it was you know, sad for us, but it was a beautiful experience. You know,
well, you made the most of it too, it sounds like.
Yeah, to let her go, you know, as easily as possible. On through the being born really into her next experience.
Absolutely. What a great way of looking at that, and that's exactly what our faith should be telling us, is that, you know, we are being born into the next life. Thank you so much for sharing that, Dave.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Oh, you're Boulder people, how are you doing on the flood situation?
Well, most of us are doing really well, and we got
right.
through it without a whole lot of trauma,
major
but we
damage.
Do have one of our second generation guys who had a pretty severe flooding. He just moved to Lyons this summer, and he got hit pretty hard, but he's handling it pretty well.
Okay, well, we'll keep that in prayer.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you know what Dave said just makes me want to read one more paragraph before we end the show. And it's, you know, I've read it before. It's one of my very favorites. It's from Paper 12, The Universe of Universes. Shows up in one of those places where you might not expect it, but it's about all about the love of God and brotherhood. And it's 12, section 7, Paper 12, section 7, paragraph 9. It says, "The love of the Father absolutely individualizes each personality as a unique child of the Universal Father, a child without duplicate in infinity, a will creature irreplaceable in all eternity. The Father's love glorifies each child of God, illuminating each member of the celestial family, sharply silhouetting the unique nature of each personal being against the impersonal levels that lie outside the fraternal circuit of the Father of all. The love of God strikingly portrays the transcendent value of each will creature, unmistakably reveals the high value which the Universal Father has placed upon each and every one of his children, from the highest creator personality of paradise status to the lowest personality of will dignity. Among the savage tribes of men in the dawn of the human species on some evolutionary world of time and space." Boyfriends, if that doesn't show you how valuable you are to your Creator, I don't think anything will. So,
well, and I would like to share one as well from the story of
Jesus and the children who would come to his carpentry shop. It's from paper 128, paragraph 6, section 11. The children were always welcome at the repair shop. Jesus provided sand, blocks, and stones by the side of the shop, and bevies of youngsters flocked there to amuse themselves. When they tired of their play, the more intrepid ones would peek into the shop, and if its keeper were not busy, they would make bold to go in and say, "Uncle Joshua, come out and tell us a big story." Then they would lead him out by tugging at his hands until he was seated on the favorite rock by the corner of the shop, with the children on the ground in a semicircle before him. And how the little folks did enjoy their Uncle Joshua. They were learning to laugh and to laugh heartily.
Beautiful.
Well, thanks for taking us out with that quote.
Yeah.
Yes, we're done. We're off the air. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in.
Thank you for all of our callers calling in to share your personal experiences, and we welcome the rest of you to call in this next week as we continue our series on developing spiritual culture in your families.
And with that, we'll say goodbye. Thank you so much, Andre and Crystalline. You're awesome. I love you so much.
Yeah, thank you,
too, Paula.
Absolutely, Paula and Crystalline. It's always a pleasure. All right,
and
you guys.
Until next week. Bye for
bye
now.
For now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.